Good afternoon. We're coming your way from St. Louis, Missouri, as the Pirates take on the St. Louis Cardinals, concluding game of the three-game series. The road trip will continue. Interleague play starts tomorrow night for the Pirates, or resumes, I should say, against the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, the first of three. But this is the concluding game of the three-game series against the St. Louis Cardinals. Stephen Brault on the hill against Miles Michaelis. And, of course, the Pirates trying to end what has turned out to be now a seven-game losing streak. And it just seems like whatever can go wrong does go wrong for this Pirates team. And we're on the telephone line with the Pirates general manager, Neil. These programs are always much more fun talking to you after a winning week. But this has been a very, very difficult time, I think, for the entire organization. And so just kind of get your thoughts on where you think the club is and now where we're hearing from fans and members of the media to do something, this organization. So where do you stand on this whole situation?
Obviously, it's been one of the toughest stretches I can remember being a part of. Even the 105-loss season, it didn't feel like we had a stretch like this. And when you're expecting to win and believe you can win and don't, that it is much harder. To lose 23 of 27 coming out of the All-Star break when we were sitting 2.5 games out of a division lead, it's been challenging, you know, and you certainly want to be the Indians who've got the best record in the American League and the Mets who've been on fire here. You certainly want to be in those team situations. We felt like we would be right in the middle of this as we entered the second week in August, the second week of September, and shoot, hopefully the second week of October. And obviously that's not playing out. We're just simply not playing well enough to win close games. 24 of the 27 games are against teams over 500, against teams that are fighting for playoff spots. And those are the teams that you need to play well to beat when you're a good team. And when you're a struggling team, 7 of the 23 losses are one run. 13 of the 23 losses are 1 to 2 plays difference, where we make a play and it's a different outcome, or the other team makes a big pitch or gets a big hit that and we weren't able to. It's a challenging stretch. 4 and 23 is painful. We certainly feel like we should be better than 4 and 23, but we also recognize that we have work to do. We recognize that we've got to tighten things up on a number of fronts. And when you go into a stretch like this one and fans' anger and the media drumbeat start, we've been through this before. The calls for the firing in 2011 when we were competitive until late July, 2012 when we were competitive, I think, into August. And then faded and had some tough finishes to those seasons and obviously turned things around at 13, 14, and 15, but not enough to win a World Series. So we have been through this before, and we definitely recognize that the focus outside is who to blame, but we're also working hard internally, and our focus is how do we get this right again? And that's what myself, who's ultimately to shoulder the responsibility and the blame for this, is me. But every single one of us is showing up every day working to find out a way, not only make one or two more plays that puts us in a game or gives us a legitimate chance to win a game, but to get this right again and to get back on track and give this fan base the team that they want to cheer for.
Neil, so you understand, obviously, the fans' frustrations. You also, I know, understand, because I know what a fan you are of the other sports and how things go about and just the way professional sports works. That old adage, you can't fire a whole team. So oftentimes a manager or a coach is let go just, if anything, to change a voice. I'm not advocating for this, but I do have to ask the question. Do you get to a point where, and Clint Hurdle has said this before, everyone has a shelf life. And sometimes managers and coaches, sometimes the message just doesn't get through anymore. I guess it's easy to ask this question when the team is struggling as it is, and it seems like there are just breakdowns kind of everywhere. At some point, do you have to consider that, or is that just absolutely off the table?
Well, I think we recognize that changes are needed, and emotional decisions are rarely good decisions, whether it's things are going really well and you make an emotional decision because they're going well, or things are not going well, and you make an emotional decision because things are not going well. We recognize that as we evaluate this in the big picture and we look to take into account as much as we can, as much relevant information as we can, and we recognize that the players in the field maybe not have enough talent because of the players that I've put on that field. Maybe we're not teaching them the way we can or need to. Maybe they're just simply not executing. So it's a combination of the players I've put on the field, the work we're doing with them, and then how the work that the players are getting done. And we recognize that our decision-making process needs to go through a thorough review. And how did we get here? And how did we go from 2.5 games out at the All-Star break to 4-23 in a really tough stretch of games, despite feeling like many of those games we could have or should have won? We recognize that we are a results-based game. At the same time, we need to take a strong, hard look at the process and how we've gotten to this point and what changes we can make going forward, and maybe what things we could have or should have done differently. Everybody has a shelf life, you know, whether it's the general manager, the manager, a coach, somebody in the front office, or somebody in their job outside of the world of professional sports. And I think if you ask Clint, he still feels the fire to help this team and help these players figure out some things. Yes, we have made mistakes. If you watch the teams that have gone 23-4 against us in this 27-game stretch, there have been mistakes made against us that either we haven't capitalized on or they've found a way to undo the damage before it was, before it resulted in runs and wins for us. Nobody's perfect. No team is perfect. We have not played well enough. We need to get some things right. And again, this team is continuing to play hard, rebuilding teams that are on the decline because they're aging and they don't have much of a farm system. That's when you kind of look to turn things over. This is a relatively inexperienced team. You go around the diamond and it's zero years of experience, 1 year of experience, 2 years of experience. And with young players come challenges, and we haven't had the ability to circle the wagon, so to speak, and to try to fight our way out of this. But I will still say these guys are showing up to fight and compete every day. We just haven't found a way to turn that corner yet.
Neil, one of the frustrations that I hear a lot, and again, you can see it in media sources and so on, is that Pirate fans' frustration, many of them, is that it's almost as if the Pirates don't seem to. Again, this is an optics, and I know I know you well enough in the organization. Just don't seem to care about winning and losing. And referring to that old movie Network, where the guy stands up and scream, "I'm mad as heck, and I'm not going to take this anymore." It's as if that's what fans want. They want to see something. Rather than just status quo. And again, I know you understand it, but I just wonder if you could talk about whatever that might be to show, for optics purposes, aesthetics, that, you know, we do care. And again, I know you do, and I know others, and I've said this to people. If you don't think Frank Coonley cares, go around Frank Coonley after a team loses a spring training game, let alone a regular season game. And I know you feel the same way.
Yeah, and I understand that the 30 years ago, people yelling and screaming and pointing fingers and showing anger was the way that people responded. Unfortunately, this generation does not respond that way. I've embarrassingly enough actually told one of our players, who was a very even keel player, that the fans need to see him snap because that will make them think he cares. When the reality is, he's probably one of the most intense players. He just doesn't show it, and it gets outside of his personality. And actually, I've regretted telling that player he should do that, and I'm glad that he hadn't done that. We each go about things in a different direction, and we get that, and then we understand that in professional sports, when a team loses more than the media thinks they should or the fans think they should, they think the solution is to blame somebody and fire somebody, and Bob Nutting and Frank Coonley may get to a point in time where that is the case. And these positions, whether it's a general manager or a manager, they are hired to be fired. And that's where, in my mind, as I watch and observe other good ones, They show up every day to do the job to the very best of their ability. Their focus is on putting teams in a position, players in a position to be successful, coaches or front office people in a position to be successful. And if we go about it the right way and we get the right people in place, the results will be wins. And that's how we will continue to show up every single day. And we get the blame game externally. Internally, we're all focused on doing our jobs the very best of our ability, doing it well enough to get back on the winning track and putting this team back in a postseason hunt.
And we'll continue with the Pirates general manager, the Neil Huntington Show, as the Pirates and Cardinals meet here in St. Louis. More to come on the Pirates Baseball Network. We're back with the Neil Huntington Show as the Pirates and Cardinals meet here this afternoon, concluding game of the series on to Anaheim. Interleague play against the Angels starting tomorrow night. And just talking about where the Buccos are right now and trying to get things straightened out. Neil, there have been some positives. We see, for example, a Joe Musgrove pitch strong five, got out of that jam in the first inning. But then that sixth inning situation occurs. Have heard some suggest that maybe Musgrove, since he has, topped out in terms of exceeded innings in the past, is there any thought at all that he would be shut down at all or limited over the next couple of months? And is that possible for any of the other pitchers?
Well, Joe is a competitor, and his goal is to make 32 starts. And ideally, I think he wanted to put himself in a position to take down 200 innings. And we've had the conversation with Joe that that's not the best way to build him up to get to a point where he can throw 200 innings and make 32 starts, and ideally even more than that if you add in October. Joe is also not 20, and he's not the young kid that you're overly concerned about overstressing. Joe's in that middle ground right now. He's still young. He's in his second full season in the big leagues. We've had conversations with him about understanding how we're going to build him up and what's the best way to build him up. And yes, there may be some games where he comes out an inning or so earlier than maybe he would have normally. We may get to a point at the end of the season where we really begin to monitor and limit his innings. But as of right now, man, he's going out there to compete and to fight and to help his club win a ball game. And there is no exact science as to when a player reaches a red flag threshold or even a yellow flag threshold. There is no perfect way to build a pitcher up. It's more art than science, and we're working with Joe to how is he recovering, how is he feeling post-start, how is he feeling between starts, how is he feeling in start, and working with him to have him as safely as possible add innings to a point where he gets to that point in time where he's a 200-inning 32-game starter during the regular season and then some as we work to make the postseason.
Neil, along those lines, not an exact science. I saw Alex Anthopoulos of the Braves say this the other day on a national radio show that at least in his mind, they're not going to limit, they're not going to shut down their young pitchers, Max Fried, Mike Soroka, because he said, I've been around with a number of organizations and just to the point where there's just no data that proves that shutting these guys down helps. They still get hurt. We've talked about this a number of times on your program, but maybe it's time to maybe just kind of revisit your thought process on that kind of thing, and maybe in terms of pitch counts. For example, Chris Archer the other day went six strong innings, back-to-back starts for him, but at 100, he was done, and this is the way it is throughout the organization, so we're not pointing the fingers at the Pirates. However, do you think at some point a team like the Pirates might consider moving beyond that 100 pitch mark? Because you, Neil, and the folks that work for you, you're always looking for that edge. And maybe an edge would be to have pitchers go beyond just 100, a guy like Chris Archer, for example.
You know, what's interesting, Brownie, is the data and the analytics would tell you the exact opposite. They would tell you that even the elite major league starters become very average when you get that third time through the order, and that's where the game has trended to getting starters out earlier, especially your non-elite starting pitchers. The Max Scherzers of the world, they're getting into that 100-plus, 105, 110 pitch count. What you're not seeing is 150 pitch counts from the old days, and that may be we've talked about baseball Darwinism before, where the players who were capable of it were allowed to do it. The players who you thought might be capable of it were allowed to do it, and they blew out never to be heard from again, and you just wondered where they went. they threw out their arm or they never recovered. Nowadays, we can have two surgeries and three surgeries, and they come back from it, but they're not the same pitcher typically coming back from surgery, although there was a little bit of a stretch there in time where the narrative was that guys came back better from Tommy John surgery, and I think on a whole, we've disproven that inaccurate narrative that the guys, all the guys, come back better. A few do. They had the game taken away from them. They got in the best shape of their life. They remotivated because they risked losing the game of baseball. There are a few examples, but the majority of players don't come back better, and unfortunately, too many of them don't come back as good. So, to your point, is there an inefficiency to be exploited? The informatics and the statistics and the analytics group would tell you absolutely not. What is interesting is, and I haven't looked at it here recently, but for the first time in a long time, the National League relievers' ERA as a whole is higher than the starters' ERA. So what we're getting is more innings from lesser relievers versus good starters or mediocre starters, and some of those lesser relievers are getting exposed, and we've experienced that here a handful of years now. The middle relief is always the weakest part of your club, and the more you have to pitch it, the more struggles you're typically going to have. So it is a double-edged sword. Are there guys that are capable of going more than 100 pitches? Yes. The same criticism about taking a guy out an inning too soon will fall heavily on the manager's head if he leaves a guy out there for 107 pitches and he gives it up in the seventh inning. So you're managing to increase probabilities, but you also have to be sensitive to that pitcher and what his workload is and how he's feeling on that given day. And you know, at the same time, we want to put guys in positions to be successful, and sometimes that means taking them out an inning earlier than they'd like to be taken out.
Let's step aside right now, allow our stations to identify themselves. Pirates home on Friday. It's a free shirt Friday plus dollar hot dogs as the Pirates host the Cubs at PNC Park. First 20,000 fans get a Clemente Bridge featured City Skyline t-shirt presented by Peoples. Dollar dog night thanks to Sugardale. Go to pirates.com/free shirt Friday. We step aside on the Pirates Baseball Network. Neil, on the subject of pitching, yesterday during the pregame, pitching coach Ray Searidge went to the defense of really the organization has been, I think, criticized, it seems like, over the last couple years when pitchers go elsewhere and there's this mentality or narrative anyway that the Pirates, quote, pitch to contact, and he was passionate about his defense that that's not the case. They pitch to get outs. And that's pretty much kind of the way the Pirates used to go about their business, 2010, 2011 kind of thing. What are your thoughts on Ray Searidge's comments, and are they in line, of course, with the team's philosophy?
Well, I think we had a ton of success with guys who were able to get ground balls and strikeouts. And so we acquired some players that we were able to maximize their abilities. When they came over here, over time, we started to shift our bullpen targets to the high riding four-seam breaking ball guys, the Neftali Felices, and now that's evolved into Michael Felice and Richard Rodriguez are some guys that have had riding fastballs that have had some success. Felipe Vasquez has had some success up there. Kyle Crick has had some success up there. And I think if you just look at the numbers, the narrative that we're a pitch-to-contact, two-seam, ground ball-oriented organization just don't play out. Our starting pitchers are actually 13th in the National League, or 13th in ground balls, ground ball rate, and our relievers are 9th. Our strikeout, we're 10th in K rate for our starters and 5th, I think, for our relievers. So that the old narrative dies hard. It's kind of like the narrative that we teach. I'm trying to remember the exact wording that was used. Teach, celebrate, and encourage pitches thrown at the head. It's a false narrative. It's not true. It's not real. We are elevating the fastball as much as anybody, which is, as we've discussed in prior shows, why some of these pitches are ending up near heads. It's not intentional, but we are intentionally throwing the ball up in the zone. And so there's a couple of false narratives that work out there right now. We are working to maximize our pitchers' individual abilities and to throw their best pitch more, which is the philosophy which has led many teams to throw more breaking balls. Trevor Williams' best pitch is his fastball, and Trevor's going to capitalize and had a ton of success a year ago by throwing his fastball. Richard Rodriguez's best pitch is his fastball. Michael Felice's best pitch is his fastball. So we have some pitchers who Felipe Vasquez's best pitch is fastball. He also happens to have two other wipeout, maybe three other wipeout pitches that he can go to. So we are embracing the throw your best pitch more. It's just sometimes your best pitch happens to be a fastball. And there are times where your strength needs to match up with that hitter's strength versus always trying to pitch to the hitter's weakness, because sometimes you pitch to your weakness and end up losing a battle that you could have gained and could have won had you just gone strength on strength. So understand Ray's frustration. Hadn't seen the comments, but I think the statistics belie that we are not a pitch to contact ground ball organization. We're trying to maximize our pitcher's strengths. We're looking to draft and acquire pitchers that have strength and traits that we can maximize and individualize our approach to, as we always have, and that has not changed.
We'll continue with the Pirates general manager, the Neil Huntington Show, as the Pirates and Cardinals meet here in St. Louis. More of the program next on the Pirates Baseball Network. We continue with the Pirates general manager, the Neil Huntington Show. Coming your way here as the Pirates and Cardinals meet in St. Louis, and we've talked about some of the positives on the club despite the losing, especially in the second half of the season. And one, of course, is the rookie Brian Reynolds. And Neil, we asked Clint Hurdle this yesterday, and just out of curiosity in terms of the analytics, Reynolds played in right field on Friday with Jose Osuna in left. Last night, Reynolds played left, Osuna in right. And today, Melky Cabrera in left and Reynolds in right. There's little doubt, of course, that the next few weeks, it's all about getting ready for 2020. And if that's the case, do you know yet where you think Brian Reynolds will be playing? Because if he were playing left field every day in 2020, you'd figure he'd be playing left field every day now. But now it makes it look like he could be bouncing around next year. Is that a possibility?
Well, Brian's a very capable defender in left and right and in center. And if he wasn't, we'd be bouncing guys around him, as, again, you're trying to maximize that day's ball game, and we feel that Brian Reynolds is more than capable of playing all three. It goes back to the false narrative that Josh Harrison was a utility player when he was in the lineup on a regular basis. It's just some days with second, third, left and right, or Adam Frazier was a utility player, or Ben Zobrist is a utility player, or Chris Bryant is a utility player, as he plays some games in right, or he plays some games in left, he plays some at third, a lot at third. It doesn't fit into a neat little package for people, so they're uncomfortable with it. And we understand that uncomfortability sometimes brings criticism. And in Bryant's case, he's very capable at all three, trying to maximize the best defense we can put behind Chris Archer or Joe Musgrove or Stephen Brault, based upon what we feel the projections are and where the highest probability of balls are going to be hit. And it's a little bit like the shift on a nightly basis, when all it takes is one ground ball that rolls through where the second baseman normally would stand. And it seems like everybody notes that. But when the line drive almost takes the pitcher's head off and there's somebody standing there, we don't note that. We don't note that's a base hit saved because of the shift. But we're very quick to note that a ground ball goes through because of the shift. And the reason why teams shift, the reason why teams adjust, is higher probabilities. And they're still playing out that way, that the where we're putting players now, more balls are being hit there than where they are, where they used to be conventionally positioned. And so that's the idea behind it, is we're trying to put the best possible defense out behind Chris Archer, Stephen Brault, and Joe Musgrove, or whomever our other starters may be, based upon the pitcher-specific matchups and the pitcher-like matchups. Where do we project the balls to be hit? How do we best cover all the ground that needs to be covered on a baseball field? And how do we maximize the positional defense and the player defense that we have out there? And Brian Reynolds happens to be a guy that's very capable and very, very able to bounce around the field and play different positions and cover the most ground where we think the most balls are going to be hit.
So you fully anticipate Gregory Polanco coming back maybe this season at some point and for next year to be the right fielder?
Well, again, we will work through exactly how the best alignment fits and who are going to be the people in that alignment. And if there's a strong case to be made for a different alignment, then we can work through that. As far as Gregory goes, yeah, Gregory is working through his rehabilitation program. He's cleared all baseball activities. Now he needs to essentially get built back up to major league game speed. And as we know, as we're seeing with Cervelli, that it's going to take some time, and when Gregory's back and ready to go this season, probably anticipate him playing some right field. But if you remember back in the day when we moved Marte to center, we moved McCutchen to right and Polanco to left because we felt that was the best defensive alignment. We'll run the numbers. We'll have the conversations. And assuming Gregory Polanco comes back and is the Gregory Polanco we expect to get back, we'll have those conversations and determine what's the best defensive alignment for our team and, most importantly, for our pitchers as we go forward.
Do you anticipate Polanco maybe doing any kind of a rehab again anytime soon, Neil?
He's working back through that, and then, yes, hopefully we'll get him out on a rehab sooner than later. And depending upon how that process goes, whether we see him before September 1st or around September 1st, it'll depend upon how he is feeling, both in the batter's box and on in right field and physically as well.
Should we read into anything regarding Will Craig playing right field again yesterday, and might he come up in September and see some outfield work?
We've talked with Will and Cole Tucker and Kevin Kramer and really the next group of infielders. At some point, you'll see O'Neill Cruz start to play a different position just to help them potentially break their way onto a major league club is what we did with Kevin Newman. It's what we've done with any number of guys over the course of the year. Got away from it a little bit with Newman and Tucker and Craig and Hayes. Early Hayes is the one guy that we've just kind of left at third base as we're working to get this bat to catch up to where his defensive abilities are at third base. So in Will Craig's case, we've got a pretty established major league player at first base and Josh Bell. And in Will's case, it's going to be hard to move him aside. So what's the best way for Will to potentially come up and help a major league club and to have some versatility to be able to go play some right field to continue to grow and get better at first base? And if Josh Bell, as we anticipate, remains at first base, where else is Will Craig going to go? So to add the defensive versatility will help him the same way it helped Newman, the same way it helped Harrison, the same way it helped, you know, all the way back to Neil Walker and Jordy Mercer and Gong and Frazier as they came through our system.
All right, we'll finish up with the Pirates general manager next on the Pirates Baseball Network. Less than a minute. Neil, just final thoughts as we go to the final break here.
Well, it's a tough stretch. We understand that. This club is continuing to fight. This club continues to care about winning. This front office continues to care about winning, and we're showing up every day. We understand the frustration. This is not where we want to be. We are working hard to get this right. We are working hard to put a good team back on the field. And that's not going to stop.
Neil, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next Sunday.
Thanks, Brandon.
The Neil Huntington Show comes your way every Sunday, and we'll again chat with the Pirates general manager, hopefully under better circumstances as the Pirates look to get a W today here in St. Louis, then on to Anaheim and back home against the Cubs starting on Friday night. The pregame show is coming up next, Down on the Farm, brought to you by Rivendell Farms and more here on the Pirates Baseball Network.